He said, ain't no big eyes and little U's, because even the dishwasher is important. Nobody likes to eat out a dirty dish. And with that thought in mind, the champ wants a clean plate, man. He said the champ wants a clean plate. And I hand him the plate. And I finished the dishes and went back over in the gym. Don't believe all the hype from Donald Trump and all of them dealt with him. You know, from every big hotel in Vegas dealt with them. Showtime, HBO, they dealt with them. All of them made money. So, you know, what it is, he's just an extreme, difficult guy when it comes to the negotiating table. He knows his position. He knows what he's got, what he got, and he don't take a step backwards from that. And he'll work day and night to get his position where it's a win-win for him. And it's been like that for years. Well, yeah, but that's a price you play for greatness. And it's sad to see guys at that. They have Frankie Randall, somebody I trained when he won all of those things. This here, it's one of those things to see Frankie, a guy who's cheerful, meeting everybody, a champion, real bright, real thing, and then see him at the stage where he couldn't remember nothing. I've seen it happen to Muhammad Ali and that. It's a sad part and a tragedy of sports.
Hello, and welcome to Boxing Life Stories with me, Tristix.
What happened in the ring after Tyson Holyfield was child's play compared to that one?
I still get goosebumps to this day.
you couldn't take the tears from his eyes or the smile off his face, could you?
I know.
I said, he's beating me. He said, well, let's pull you back.
In the paper, they made me look like Al Capone.
This is going to be your night.
His winning and his nothing else.
Hello, welcome back to Boxing Life Stories. This week, I'm with trainer Aaron Snowell, who was in the corner of the night Frankie Randall upset Julio Cesar Chavez, and the night Mike Tyson lost to James Buster Douglas in Tokyo. Aaron grew up near Muhammad Ali's training camp in Deer Lake and had a lot of exposure to life at the camp through the 1970s with the likes of Muhammad Ali and Matthew Saab Muhammad and Eddie Mustafa Muhammad. But Aaron's also worked with the likes of Tim Austin, Tim Witherspoon, whom he cornered when he beat Frank Bruno in England, and many others. I found this interview of Aaron really interesting, actually. He's a Don King lieutenant and provides a very alternate history to the one we're accustomed to hearing about the rise and fall of Mike Tyson. And on this podcast, I don't really ever make anyone right or wrong. I just want people to hear the stories and make up their own minds from there. I bumped into Aaron at the International Boxing Hall of Fame, just on the grounds, and we'd spoken on the phone, actually, earlier in the year. But this was my first time meeting him, and I left not necessarily thinking differently, but opening my eyes to the narrative we have been told through the years and how it was pushed. Now, again, I'm not saying what's right and what's wrong, but I am saying I found it interesting that if I open my eyes, I could, or open my mind, I could see and understand a different perspective. So I thought that, therefore, this podcast has a lot of value because it's something we don't hear too often. Before I get to Aaron, we are brought to you by Hanson Lee Resourcing, and they were voted the UK's best specialist insurance sector recruitment firm at the Corporate Excellence Awards. Not only do Hanson Lee find you the best people, they'll help you retain them, and you can find out more at hansonlee.com. And now here's Aaron Snowell. So, Aaron, it's great to meet you. You've been in the game for so many years. Like, what's your first boxing memory?
My first boxing memory? Muhammad Ali.
On TV?
The greatest of all times. No, when he first came to Deer Lake, Pennsylvania in 1970, he met my family, and that's my pitch.
So you mentioned you're from Pottsville, so that's right there. That's right down the road from the camp.
Yeah, from Deer Lake, Pennsylvania. It's the home of Yingling beer, the oldest beer in the world. And the start of the NFL. NFL started in that region, the Pottsville Maroons.
What's the name of the beer? The
Yingling.
Yingling, yeah. When I went to Deer Lake,
I went to the
tour, Yingling factory. Yeah,
you did. Take the tour, and at the end, they give you some beer,
That's
right?
How I knew it was Pottsville. That's how I knew I'd been to Pottsville.
Yeah, that's my hometown.
Okay, great. So So how did you, what did you, when you first went up to Deer Lake, what were you trying to do? Just meet Ali and hang out?
Well, we ventured up there to meet him. This before the cabins and all that. Just had trailers up there where they were staying in at the time. And he invited me and my family into the trailer because he didn't know there was black people around there.
Wow. And what was that like? Was that surreal? I mean, obviously, so, was Ali someone that you'd either listened to on the radio or seen on the TV and that kind of stuff?
Well, Muhammad Ali always made people feel like he knew him for a million years, even though you only knew him for, didn't know him. You just seen him on TV. But that's the type of personality Ali was. And he opened his arms around us. I'm going to tell you a little a funny story. When we met Ali that day, he invited us into the trailer. His bed was there. He told me and my brothers and sisters, there's 10 of us and my family. He says, wait. Here, I'll be right back. Came back with a briefcase opening up and had a briefcase full of money and left out of the door and didn't come back for a long time. So when he came back in the door, you know, me and my brothers and sisters, all of us, he sat down on the bed. He counted his money. He said, you mean to tell me all my money's here? He said, man, y'all from the projects and y'all don't steal? He said, I can't believe this. So he said, I want to meet your mother. And he came up into the projects in Fairmont Avenue in Pottsville, up on top of the mountain. The projects is up on the mountain. And he met my mother. He said to my mother, he said, look, you find the biggest house around here, I'll buy it for you. And your family. My mother told him, no, we ain't did nothing that we ain't supposed to do for you to buy us a home. My mother told him, she said, take that money and save it because one day you're going to need it. And my mother told him, good Lord took care of us this far and he's going to take care of us the rest of the way. Ali said, I can't believe this. So that's how we were able to spend time around him. And he put us in commercials and stuff like that.
Did you box?
Yeah, a little bit to learn how to fight. We were in a car accident, my whole family, and a tractor trailer truck hit his head on, and I suffered a brain injury. I couldn't box.
Oh wow!
Because of the brain injury, but you know, I used to have to get in there and spar and things to learn how to do it.
Yeah.
But I couldn't box.
So, what was your first job in boxing?
My first job in boxing was sweeping the floors and doing dishes at Muhammad Ali's training camp. And while Ali was tuning us at night and stuff like that, washing dishes. I'm going to tell you a funny story. Bodini Brown, one day I was doing dishes in the camp. And he walked in the kitchen. Lana Shabazz was the chef at the time, and I'd do the dishes. Boudini walked in the door. He said, man, let me tell you something. He said, ain't no big eyes and little U's because even the dishwasher is important. Nobody likes to eat out a dirty dish. And with that thought in mind, the champ wants a clean plate, man. He said, the champ wants a clean plate. And I hand him the plate. And I finished the dishes and went back over in the gym.
Were you in town in Deer Lake when some of the big names came to town, like the Jackson Five? And
oh,
that
absolutely. Michael Jackson came to my house. and when Ali knew that they were coming, he would invite us down. He'd call us and tell us to come on down that Jackson Five were coming. Chris Christopherson, Isaac Hayes. Hal Melvin in the Blue Notes. You know, a lot of great fighters were around Muhammad Ali all the time.
Yeah, sure. So obviously, Larry Holmes and Timmy Witherspoon served an apprenticeship there as well.
Well, you know, Larry Holmes, I'm going to tell you, when Muhammad Ali was getting ready for to fight George Foreman over in Zaire, he came and did an exhibition. In my middle school, my sister and them, they didn't have no uniforms for the band.
Okay.
And Ali came in and did an exhibition to raise money for that. And in that gym, Larry Holmes, with 9 professional fights, sparred Muhammad Ali. That's how far we go back. Wow.
And
I'll show you a video of it. And me and Muhammad Ali rapping, he put us in an ice cream commercial. St. John's ice cream is good to eat. Fills your stomach and saves your teeth. Hey, kids, our next big fight is Tooth Decay. And we won a Grammy Award with that, with Frank Sinatra and all of them in the cover. Four of my siblings under me were also in that commercial, an ice cream commercial thing.
Hey, so that's a big gig, right? Working in Ali's training camp straight away. How does it... You can't get any better than that.
Well, I tell people...
Everything has to be downhill after that, sure.
Well, I started on top and finished on top. You got to remember that. And, and every knock's a boost. You know, Muhammad Ali told us when we were young, we could be anything that we wanted to be as long as you believe in God.
Yeah.
And I sure enough believe in God. You know, I'm a Muslim because of Muhammad Ali. And the most joy in life that I did was during Black History Month a year ago, we to Muhammad Ali's training camp, which now is the Fighter Haven.
Yeah.
We bring Muhammad Ali Jr. up there, and the first time in his life, he led prayer in the mosque that his father built.
Wow.
For Black History Month, we had the Jack Johnson exhibit and all that there at the camp. So
yeah, I've been up to Fighters Heaven. They've done it. Is it like it used to be? With the renovation they've done?
Yeah, it's exactly the way it used to be.
Really? Wow. So they've done a really good job then.
Yeah, Madden, he did an incredible job to restore it. The gym is like it. You know, everything's like it. The dorms, the cabins, and
Who was in your dorm back in the day?
Well, you have Muhammad Ali's amateur team there, Muhammad. A professional amateur sports with Harold Smith.
Wow.
You had Tony Tubbs, Tony Tucker, Leo Randolph, who became the first champion for Muhammad Ali professional sports. You had Chuck Bodak. You had Joe Cloud, who was the coach of the team. You had Roosevelt Green, Showtime Stoudemire. Charles Carter, you know.
So when you talk about Harold, did you work for Harold in MAPS?
No, because back in the day, it was 80, 82.
Muhammad, yeah, around about that. Yeah.
Muhammad, I'll show you some newspaper articles. He had made me the director of trainer.
Okay.
For him.
What? So, were you on the East Coast or in Santa Monica where his team was?
No, the team was all of them in Deer Lake at one time. Then they went out to Santa Monica when Muhammad Ali went out to Santa Monica when he was out in California. But most of them, the best fighters in the country, were there at the training camp. And Lana Shabazz, she was the chef for the Muhammad Ali team.
Yeah, and Matthew inherited her down the line because she was working in Matthew's camp for a while as well.
Yeah, Matthew saw Muhammad hired Lana Shabazz. Yeah. Not only was she a Muslim, but she's a great chef, and she was the chef for Muhammad Ali for years.
And then I have pictures of Matthew in the camp with Eddie Mustafa and Muhammad as well.
Yeah, well, we all were there. You know, I was with Slim Robinson, who taught me how to train fighters. To be a trainer. He was training Eddie Mustafa at the time, and I was assistant training for Eddie Mustafa. Eddie Gregory, after we beat Marvin Johnson, we were part of that when he won the title in Knoxville, Tennessee on the undercard of John Tate, Mike Weaver. What a night.
With the body shots that Marvin still can't figure out how to defend. All these years on, he still says, I could still box Eddie Gregory now. I still wouldn't know what to do with the body shots.
Well, it was something that we worked on, the fight of Southpaw. It was all part of it. To hit his left hook to the body, straight right hand, left hook to the body, you know, take his leg out from him. And then send that right hand, because Eddie Mustafa was a hell of a right hand puncher.
Sure.
And Slim Robinson just sharpened those skills. And with Ali, it was a funny thing that happened, is that Bob Arum and Eddie Mustafa was in a purse bid, and Eddie was a number one contender. They couldn't come to agreement with Murad Muhammad with Triangle Productions, and with Ben Muhammad, they couldn't come to an agreement.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? So. It went to a purse bid, and Eddie Mustafa only got, when he fought for the title, something like $25,000, $20,000, $5,000 training expenses. And Muhammad Ali said, don't worry about it. He said, I'm going to take care of your training. And he said, you stand up and get free and stay free. And that's what Eddie did. Ali paid for the training expenses, all of that, with Mustafa went and fought. And he went and won and bring the champ title, WBA title, back to the camp.
And that light heavyweight division was a complete shark tank, wasn't it? There were so many guys. Rossman, James Scott, Yaki Lopez, Marvin, Eddie, Victor Galindez. Yeah,
Mike Rossman.
Yep.
Yeah, Mike Rossman, Victor Galindez.
John Conte, obviously, from the UK.
Yeah, John Conte, Murray Sutherland.
Yep.
Yeah, the
list. Jerry the Bull.
Yeah, Jerry the Bull Martin, you know. The list was long. Richie Cates.
Yep.
You know, the list is long, fine, and distinguished at
and
that time.
Michael Spinks.
Dwight
Carvey, Braxton.
Yeah. Well, Michael Spinks rose to be the king of that era. He was on top of the mountain. Then he went on to fight Larry Holmes and became heavyweight champion. But all of us were together around in those days.
So you mentioned your education from Slim. Did you get help in Ali's camp as well with guys obviously Angelo Dundee, I mean, but Luis Saria and those guys?
Boudini, Brown, Saria. You had Kit Gavilan.
His name was one of the rocks.
Gavilan. Stanley Sadler.
Okay, yeah.
Man, the list is on and on and on and on, the guys that came through. But they would sit and talk to you, give you little pointers about this and that. And to make a great trainer, you know, you can't teach everybody to fight the same way.
No, sure.
You have to know what kind of style a person has and teach it, or what he's trying to do. And then you got to teach him how to do that with form and technique that brings speed, that brings power. And then after that, it becomes conditioning. You know, by doing roll work, doing the rounds, hitting the heavy bag, the speed bag, the hand pads, sit-ups, all of those stuff. So it's a comprehensive program when it comes to training. It just ain't fight, fight, fight all the time.
You must have seen through your links with Ali and with Matthew Saad Muhammad, a lot of people we call hangers-on, right? And entourages, like, how do you feel about that with, I suppose, with hindsight, knowing how much it's cost guys in the past with their careers and their fortune? Not necessarily guys who've paid their dues in the sport and been around, but guys who come in and
well, some guys try to steal the thunder, and some people are about the thunder. Muhammad Ali had a lot of people around him, but everybody that was around Muhammad Ali, his inner circle, all of them had a purpose, all of them had a reason. And let me tell you, all of them were great and terrific, and they were good about what they do.
Yeah.
And, you know, they talk about great managers and things like that. We're here at the International Boxing Hall of Fame. I look on the wall, see all of these great managers and stuff like that. But how does the greatest of all time manager, Herbert Muhammad, which was Elijah Muhammad's son and was his manager for a long time, not be inducted into any Hall of Fame?
Yeah, so I spoke to Murad Muhammad about this, and he said basically Herbert changed the face of the sport.
He absolutely did. He helped start Top Rank.
Yeah.
And we know what Top Rank turned into today, but in terms of negotiating, fighting overseas, going into the Arab world where you have kings and presidents of Africa, putting up money to see the greatest of all times, Muhammad Ali. You got to understand, in Islam, Muhammad is the prophet. That name carries a lot of weight. And Ali is one of what they call the Khalifa. So Muhammad Ali in the Arab world, in the Middle East, that's why his name took off so big. And Elijah Muhammad knew that when he gave it to him.
So what did you make of Matthew as a person and as a fighter, Matthew Saad Muhammad?
Well, Matthew Saad Muhammad, when he changed his name.
Yeah, from Matthew Franklin.
He was a gentleman and a scholar, really. just a great person, a great individual all around. But what people may not know about Saad is life situations toughen you up. But you got to do your part too. And let me tell you, Saad Muhammad trained hard, bro. He put that work in, man. You can't take a licking and keep on ticking like him and then at the end of the day knock guys out and be on the top of the game. Matthew Saad Muhammad, he was it.
We didn't know then what people know now about head injuries and that kind of stuff. But looking back through the clippings and stuff, there were people saying Matthew can't keep going to the well like he did. It's going to affect him at some point. Were you aware of that back in the day?
Yeah. Well, you know, you got to limit the times that you get hit with punches when you're in big fights. It takes a tally on you. And, you know, in the long run situations in life, it took a tally on him. But Saad Muhammad was a gentleman and a scholar, man, a real classy guy. And you talk about Eddie Mustafa, same way. Muhammad Ali just fell in love with both of them, and he had a lot of respect for both of them. And Muhammad Ali set out to help them, and he did help them.
So what do you make of Harold Smith and what he did in boxing?
Well, he came in fly by night, and he left fly by night.
Yeah, so but after going through like $21 million.
Well, he was giving it out, and people were coming to get it.
People were loving it. People were loving it.
Yes, they were. And we were out there with it all, and he was giving out, and we did it.
He loved the boxers, right?
Well, it wasn't about the bouts. As they found out later on down the line,
yeah,
there was a bigger scheme of how he was going to get bigger money.
Yeah,
down the line, if certain fights happen where they can put certain monies back and things that after time went on, they found out all of that. But he was something. He was giving it out, and I'm glad that he wanted to give it to some boxers because they need it.
Yeah, so what you're referring to was that bill at Madison Square Garden. This is it.
Yeah,
with Matthew against Eddie in the rematch. God, Jerry Cooney was on the bill, and Tommy Hearns, Benitez.
Yeah, all the great ones, Aaron Pryor, you know.
They were all lined up.
Yeah, they were all lined up.
So after Harold Smith and after Eddie retired, you were still in the sport, right?
Don King. I was with Don King. Tim Witherspoon had won the heavyweight championship when he beat Greg Page. For the WBC title after Larry Holmes gave up the WBC title, wanting to fight the number one contender, Greg Page. And Tim Witherspoon was sitting number two. Him and Greg Page fought for that title and won it.
So you were with Don King basically through all his glory years of the 80s. And I say glory years, I mean, obviously not everyone sees it as glory years, but what was it like being in, you were a King lieutenant, right?
Yeah, why not? Hey, look, he had fighters. People needed to be trained, and you can't do something without work.
Yeah.
And you have to work at it. And we worked at it, all of us. In the camp, training camp, Carl King, Debbie King, Miss King. We had a winning solution. Give the fighters what they need, put them in the right atmosphere. And the training camp is in a secluded place where Amish buggies and things like that.
In Ohio.
In Ohio, yep. Orwell, Ohio, and have them train and give them the right nourishment. Chef Early was the chef, and the rest is history. The champ, it was a manufacturing place where we just kept rolling out champions.
So some of those fighters, you know, years down the line, obviously Jack Newfield brought out a book, didn't he, The Life and Crimes of Don King and stuff. Some of those guys didn't speak too well of King through that era. Like, what was your take on that with Don being manager or Don being promoter, Carl being manager?
Well, don't believe the hype. Don't believe the hype. In time, he went in front of a court of his peers, and the court of his peers found him not guilty of all of that kind of stuff that they talked about, 169 counts of tax evasion they had to read in the New York lower Manhattan federal court. So it tells you he had to be doing something right, because one account, he would have spent a lifetime in prison. So like I tell people, don't believe all the hype from Donald Trump and all of them dealt with him. You know, from every big hotel in Vegas dealt with him, Showtime, HBO. They dealt with him, all of them made money. So, you know, what it is, he's just an extreme, difficult guy when it comes to the negotiating table. He knows his position, he knows what he's got, what he got, and he don't take a step backwards from that. And he'll work day and night to get his position where it's a win-win for him. And it's been like that for years.
Yeah, one of the things people have always said about him is his work ethic.
Oh, he works day and night. You ain't going to outwork him. Because when you sleep, he up plotting on something. He hits you in the middle of the night. But Seth Abraham of HBO, who is the president, said it no better and direct. He said, Don King is crackling bright.
Yeah.
And he said he's a Harvard graduate. He said, but Don King's crackling bright. He couldn't do it. And in the end, when they had Mike Tyson, what broke the relationship up with Don King and HBO and Seth Abraham, they spoke every day for 15 years.
Right.
And it was a guy named Iron Mike Tyson, who was undisputed, undefeated heavyweight champion of the world, is that they couldn't come to agreement for $1 million.
Wow.
$99 million, Seth Abraham said to Don, I ain't giving you the 100. Don said, oh, you gonna give me the 100. He said, you got to give me the 100, else I'm walking. Seth Abraham said, no, Don, it's 99, and that's it. 99, then he didn't put it on. And what had the birth of Showtime was Iron Mike Tyson. They gave Mike Tyson over $100 and some million to come to Showtime.
So the Tyson stuff's interesting, because you were right there in the center when he switched, when he left Kevin Rooney, who's really the last piece of that previous puzzle.
Yeah, with Jim Jacobs, Bill Caton, and
Cuss.
Cuss the model, yeah.
And you were part of that sort
of... And Jim Jacobs.
So you were around when he obviously flipped to Rory Holloway and John Horn and stuff.
Yeah.
And what was that period of time like?
Well, it was a great period of time. Mike Tyson was on the top of his game, you know, during that time. He was going through a divorce,
yeah,
with Robin Gibbons. And Mike Tyson, when I started training... He was probably over 300 and some pounds.
Wow. Okay.
And I was training Julian Jackson at the time at King's training camp. And that's how I started training Mike. He came down there and asked me to help him lose weight.
Okay.
And I started helping him lose weight, and he burned it off. And then, you know, one thing led to another. Mike works hard, man.
What was your first fight with Mike?
Bruno.
So the first Bruno fight in Vegas.
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah.
We left from 10 days before the fight. Me, him, Don King, John and Rory, we left from Las Vegas, went to Santo Domingo, and got Mike Tyson a divorce in Santo Domingo, hopped back on the plane and went back. We trained in Florida, where we had to switch planes to fly over and trained over, and then came back to Las Vegas.
Was Mike... in a good way at that time, obviously with the new camp and with John and Rory around him? Or yeah, was he in a bad way with the divorce and everything else?
Well, Mike was like anybody that goes through a divorce. It's rough.
Yep.
Especially somebody, Mike Tyson loved Robin Gibbons, you know, and it's hard to say goodbye. It's hard to, all of that. He went through all of the feelings and emotion that any human being would go through. When you separate from somebody that you love, you know, and especially your first love, to somebody that you really love, you care for. But, you know, and also she broke his heart, you know, to say something like that on the Barbara Walters special. And then Kevin Rooney was coming out saying stuff about that. Kevin Rooney hurt himself with that whole deal.
With the lawsuit.
Well, let me tell you what, man. that lawsuit that they had was bogus. Bogus.
Because there was no contract?
No contract. And in this state, you can't have a long-term contract, a lifetime contract with nobody. It's against the law. That's slavery. Bogus. Right. And Mike Tyson never challenged it. But you can't have a contract. That's outright slavery. And plus, Jim Jacobs and Bill Caton and Custom Model bring Mike Tyson to Don King. He didn't have to steal him. They bring him to him. You ever hear a fighter named Edwin Rosario?
Yeah, sure.
Okay. Remember the fight when Julio Cesar Chavez and Edwin Rosario fought?
Yeah.
You know who was Edwin Rosario's manager was at the time?
It was Jacobs, right?
All right.
Yeah.
Top rank, Mike Tyson was with him fighting on ESPN. They didn't want to give Mike Tyson and Jim Jacobs the money. When he came to Don, Don said, all right. And because Don gave Edwin Rosario the most money that he ever made in a fight with Jim Jacobs said, hey, I'm bringing Mike Tyson. And he did.
You provide a real good look at this period of time because obviously, you know, you allude to it there. It looks like Tyson's being brainwashed and led against his will, right? That's the narrative, right?
Well, the narrative is all of those sports writers at the time that were in love with Jim Jacobs and Kevin Rooney and Steve Lott and all of those guys. And they pushed the envelope to talk bad about Don.
Yeah. Which do you
Ron
see?
Ron Katz, Michael Katz and John Saraceno, all of those guys and guys writing for the USA Today
yeah.
and the Post and all that. You know, it all goes with the territory, but the proof of the mix is, and if you look at old contracts with Don King, when Mike Tyson came, Jim Jacobs and Mike Tyson's name are on them because Jim Jacobs is the one who bring Mike Tyson.
But that Bruno fight was where people said for the first time that Mike wasn't bulletproof because he got clipped by a left hook, right?
Well, it ain't the first time that Mike Tyson got clipped with a punch. You got to understand something. Did he win the Olympics?
No.
The Olympics is the biggest prize in amateur sports, right? Did he win the World Games?
No.
That's the second biggest prize. Now, who was training him then?
Teddy Atlas.
No.
Rooney.
Kevin Rooney, okay. And Custom Model. Okay, so let's get the picture right. You know what I mean?
Yeah, sure, but obviously...
And they want to say things, including Teddy Atlas. You know... He says things with no facts to back it up. None. When you had Mike Tyson, you couldn't even get him to win the biggest prize in amateur sports. Let's look at that realistically. It's called the Olympics. He didn't make it. Got beat by the same guy twice. It was a star that he didn't learn how to whoop. Henry Tillman had a star that's difficult for Mike Tyson.
Right. And, yeah, it was Tillman who beat him in the Olympic qualifiers, right?
Or the there you go.
Yeah. So from the Bruno fight, how long were you with Mike for? What was your last fight? Was that the Douglas fight, the last one?
No.
You went on beyond that?
Yeah, when we bring him back. Ruddock, with Ruddock, matter of fact, Henry Tillman. With us training him, he knocked Henry Tillman out cold.
So tell me about the Tokyo experience. I mean, Mike's gone on the record and said that basically... Is this right? You might know this. They had to change all the female hotel staff.
Oh.
You're smiling at that. You know where I'm going with this.
Well, you know, Mike Tyson says, I love him. He knows what guys are going to bite on. He knows what's going to sell because once he puts it out there, they take it and carry it all around. Let me tell you, Mike Tyson, he didn't train. And he didn't want nobody to train him.
Because he got put down in sparring out there, right?
Yeah, Greg Page knocked him down. Yeah. But he had came late. We were already over there. He had came late over there to Japan.
Because he didn't see Buster Douglas as a threat?
Well, he underestimated him.
Yeah.
You know, he started listening to all the things that he can take on the heavyweight division on one night and all that. But let me tell you, when Mike Tyson wants to work hard and he lets you push him, he's one of the greatest fighters of all times. He'll let you push him second to none.
Yeah.
He'll climb a mountain that not too many guys can climb in training. Oh, yeah. But that's what makes him, that's why he's a great fighter.
And obviously people subsequently said, questioned Mike's heart and different things, saying that he was an on-top fighter and stuff. But he showed heart there in Tokyo, right?
Let me tell you. The shot he got hit with in Tokyo, remember, there was a long count in the fight. The referee just didn't, he just didn't have that thing. Everything was off key. That shot he got hit with that finally stopped him, he got hit square dead on the butt. Ain't too many guys can get up and walk away from that and finish the fight on their feet, not yet and ready to fight. When I got in the ring with Mike, while he was on his feet, he asked me, he said, "What happened?" I said, "He got knocked out, champ," and I grabbed him so he wouldn't fall. But he put everything that he had in it that night. But when Mike Tyson's training, he's invincible because he'll work the fighter plan with guys with style, with pressure fights and all that. And that movement that Mike Tyson does back and forth, left to right with his head and all that, it's difficult.
Yeah.
You have to practice it and practice it and practice different moves, stepping over, twist out to the side, you know, and cutting the ring off and stuff like that. You have to work the fundamentals of that over and over and over and over to perfect it.
Sure.
And when you don't want to work that, because it's hard work, it has to deal with speed. Mike Tyson's one of the fastest heavyweights of all times.
Yeah.
So you have to look that.
So there was a lot of criticism on you and the guys in the corner that night, wasn't there?
Yeah.
About, I think the story was there was no end swell and all that kind of stuff.
Right.
Did you take any of that personally, and you deserve any of it?
Well, you deserve something when you fail to prepare. You know, we had a cut man that didn't bring his stuff, so, you know, you got to take the heat as the head trainer. I take the heat, whatever, you know, but the responsibility's on me. Whether he wins or loses is on me. I can take it because I understand the bigger picture of it.
How, by the way, obviously I mentioned Rory Holloway and John Horn. What were they like?
Oh, hey, look. They were friends of Mike and Mike wanted them there. So, hey.
Were they did actors what or comedians or?
Well, I don't know what they were. Mike Tyson said they were his managers, so I guess they were managing.
Yeah, sure. So coming back from Tokyo, obviously, well, I mean, Tyson didn't fight again for a while because he went to Indianapolis, right? And then everything went sideways.
Yeah, well, look, man, when you sew them wounds and stuff like that, and when you get your a so-called tough fight, your butt, you know, it's just... it's difficult. You have to soul search yourself to say that you really want it. And he knew he wasn't doing things the correct way. And it makes you say, if I got to do this and on this level, I'm going to have to soul search and get it like I had it. I got to have that hunger drive and stuff like that. And he does it. The Roy Jones thing, with him and Roy Jones just did that exhibition. At that age, you can see Mike Tyson put his time in again. Yeah. He had the fire, he had the desire, and he had the will to do it.
Yeah.
Even at this age, and to repeat that, the movement in motion and all that. And it was good to see him do that. It was, because he is a great fighter.
Did you go see him in jail?
I was in Indianapolis at the time. We were protesting with Minister Louis Farrakhan and things like that. And the imam who was in there teaching him is a dear friend of mine who passed, Sadiq. You know, he was a friend of ours, Muhammad Ali, and all of us, Captain Yusuf Shah, who was a food of Islam, all of them. He was our friend.
There was all this speculation when Mike came out that he wasn't going to go back with King, right?
hey, look, where else was he going? Regardless of what people want to say, Don King and Mike Tyson doing what they do together is greater than them being separate.
Do you see that? Do you think that now? Because obviously they've fallen out.
Absolutely.
Because there was a thing up here like a few years ago. Do you remember that? When,
yeah.
Do you know where I'm going with this?
Yeah.
When Mike threw a drink at Don.
You know, I don't think it was someone. They just did a little something. But, you know, they since been eating meat for lunch and stuff like that. You know, they do things better together than they do separate and individual. Mike is growing vastly from where he used to be. He's a gentleman and a scholar, you know, and he's constantly growing and constantly changing like all of us.
When was the last time you spoke to Mike?
Well, it's been a while. It's been some time. But, hey, look, I don't have no hard feelings, and he doesn't have any hard feelings against me. God bless him.
So back in the day, when you were part of that, when you were doing all the stuff with King in that sort of 80s, 90s heydays, you mentioned Julian Jackson. What was he like to work with?
Phenomenal.
Hardest pound for pound hitter that you took on the
pad? Yeah, Julian Jackson would sit and he'd let you grind him, sharpen his skills, and listen. Julian Jackson, you set a plan down what we're going to do, like when he knocked Terry Norris out. We knew Terry Norris was fast, had quick hands, could box real well. So we worked on slipping and counter. And Julian slipped, bang, a right hand, and put him out for the night.
Were you with him for the Harold Graham fight?
Yeah, in the States, yeah. I just didn't go over there.
No, that was in Marbella, right?
Yeah.
In Marbella, yeah.
So. Yeah, when he knocked out Buster Drayton on CBS, when he point down. You know, there's a lot of times great fights I trained.
What about the McClellan fights?
The McClellan fights, no.
No.
No, I didn't train him.
Who else were you working with in those King days?
Frankie Randall when he beat Julio Cesar Chavez.
Wow,
the opening of the MGM Grand.
The late Frankie Randall.
Yeah.
Who was a superb fighter back in the day.
Yeah, I trained him, yeah. I mean, he knocked out Aaron Rosario to get the number one spot and then knocked out Julio Cesar Chavez. He's another one should be here. He should be in strength because he got the lineage.
He was also a guy who helped a young Floyd Mayweather quite a lot. Did you know that? He helped spar Floyd a lot back in the day?
Yeah, I know he helped spar. Floyd used to train with me.
Okay.
I know how he got where he's at. Don Hale and Dr. Hale were Frankie's managers.
Okay, yeah.
Floyd used to live with Don Hale.
Yes, who has like the clinic, right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
And They came because I was training Frankie. They asked me
okay.
if they could come to the training camps and stuff like that, Floyd, when he was young, and he did.
So you must have known Vonzell Johnson as well, right?
I know Vonzell very well when Vonzell Johnson was fighting, too.
He's a legend.
Yeah,
Vonzell. I mean, I like Vonzell a lot. He's a good guy.
Yeah, from Columbus, Ohio.
He was a godfather, I think, of Floyd's. But he also fought Matthew.
Yeah. But
look at all these Floyd, ties that bind, hey? It's crazy.
Yeah, but Floyd, you know, he learned a lot. He picked up stuff in the gyms and stuff like that, and he utilized.
Did you see the talent? Did you know what he was going to become?
Oh, yeah, he definitely had talent. We tried to sign him many times. We did.
At DKP?
Yeah. Yep, tried to sign him when he was coming up. But you got to have a respect for him because he gambled. And he took the gamble, he took the risk, and, you know, he made it. But Roger, his uncle, was a great fighter and a great trainer, you know, along with his father. But his uncle, Roger, was a great fighter, so it was good.
Yeah, of course. I think it sort of goes lost a little bit how good Roger was because he was a problem for everybody.
Yeah, he can knock people out. Had great punt.
So let me ask you this. Obviously, Roger was struggling towards the end of his life and stuff. Do you ever?
Yeah, God bless him.
And obviously, we talked about Matthew, who struggled in the end too, and Muhammad, obviously. Do you sometimes have to check yourself about your passion for the sport? When you see how much it can take from the guys?
Well, yeah, but that's a price you pay for greatness. And it's sad to see guys at that. They have Frankie Randall, somebody I trained when he won all of those things. This here, it's one of those things to see Frankie, a guy who's cheerful, meeting everybody, a champion, real bright, real thing, and then see him at the stage where he couldn't remember nothing. I've seen it happen to Muhammad Ali and that. It's a sad part and a tragedy of sports that happens. You know, same way you see basketball players, their fingers bent or limping with their knees and stuff from running and jumping up and down. It's football players, you know, with concussions and, you know, back injury, leg injury, and things like that. So, hey, it's fatalities are part of the sport, but that's what they wouldn't have it any other way, or they wouldn't want it any different.
Hey, so you're part of a Ali era, right, where he was an endeared and beloved figure, and you were part of a Tyson era where he was known for chaos and carnage.
Yeah.
Were both rides extremely different rides to be on?
Oh, absolutely, because Muhammad Ali is the greatest of all time.
As a person and a fighter.
Yeah, and Mike Tyson's a great fighter on that line of Muhammad Ali. But Mike Tyson was shy. Muhammad Ali wasn't shy. When Mike Tyson was younger, he was real shy about being around with people because of the trust issue. Muhammad Ali, he loved everybody.
Yeah.
He'd sit and talk to you for hours, sign the autographs for hours, all of that. So we have to look at those different types of scales. But in the end of the day, both of them was great. And it's a blessing from God for me to have ties to the both of them. I like that.
And Mike also came at a time where journalists were after sensational stuff, maybe more so than Muhammad's time, right? So these guys wanted Mike Tyson to implode and self-destruct.
No, Jim Jacobs, you know, he was a manager, but he also worked public relations. Jim Jacobs used to do a lot of historical stuff for boxing.
Sure, he had the big fights and stuff.
Even like Muhammad Ali, he had one of the largest libraries called Big Fight Inc. So the old thing and back in the day, say, hey, look, we go get the writers, go buy them some drinks and give them a few dollars and hey, let them write some stuff on your guys. And that's what they did with Jim Jacobs. And plus, with the New York crew, when you have them on your side, that power of the pen with the New York thing that Jim Jacobs had, man, was second to none. And that's what lifted Mike Tyson's career, was that great big New York PR.
Yeah, of course. Did Mike care what people thought back in the day?
A little bit. Mike used to read. He used to read the magazines and read them books, you know. But it's something. But that's what propelled his greatness.
People also thought that, like, you know, Mike. I don't know if I don't want to say forget where he came from, but if I say that, you'll know roughly what I mean.
No. I know Mike have never forgot where he came from.
What about, like, when was he still studious of fight films, or was he getting a bit sick of the fight game back then?
No. He's a student of the game, like I'm a student of the game. We obtain tremendous knowledge with every day we're around it. You can't never forget what you come from, because you know where you're going. And you know what it all means. And you understand it. He understands the game, and he knows where he's going. He knows where he's at, and he's doing it. For a senior statesman as a fighter, a great fighter, he understands all the responsibility that goes along with all that.
You mentioned Timmy Witherspoon earlier. How good was Tim?
Tim was good, you know.
Better than he's given credit for.
Better than he's getting credit for. To have that limited amateur career. To fight Larry Holmes, a hell of a fight with 15 fights all together. Tim's amateur and professional fights, he probably only had maybe 18, 20 fights, and to put up a fight against Larry Holmes, one of the greatest heavyweights of all times, to have all them title defenses to show. The thing that hurt Tim Witherspoon, let me tell you this, is that night when he didn't win, that fight hurt him, because he never, ever trained as hard. He wouldn't let you push him like he
did for Larry.
For Larry.
So
he's a two-time, and he's another one. He should be here. He's a two-time heavyweight champion. When there was not too many two-time heavyweight champions, it was Muhammad Ali and Floyd Patterson, and Tim Witherspoon was the third.
Were you in
time.
The corner when he fought Bruno?
Yeah.
So you've come up a couple of times up against Frank.
Yeah. Yeah, I was with him. Frank, I love Frank. Frank's a dear friend of mine, Frank Bruno. But, yeah, I was there, the overhead right, yeah.
And then after Tyson, who were you around then and when Tyson went away?
When Tyson went away, Frankie Randall, I trained there. Tim Austin.
Okay.
Nate Jones. A lot of other
Nate Jones was in 96 Olympics. Nate Jones,
he came out in 90. Don Hill,
and he's another Floyd guy. Nate, and he was in the Mayweather camp, wasn't he? Later on down the line,
yeah. All of them guys were with me.
Okay,
training. So
and Timmy Austin, another seriously underrated guy.
Yeah, Tim Austin can go. He can fight.
The Cincinnati kid, right?
Yeah, Cincinnati kid.
What was Timmy like to train?
Discipline, like Julian Jackson.
Was he?
Yeah, Tim Austin could whack too.
What's Timmy up to these days?
He's doing well. He got his own little businesses and stuff going on. He was just in Atlantic City Hall of Fame when I got inducted.
Oh, okay.
Yeah,
okay.
I just talked to him. But look, man, we're slowing up. We've been at it a little bit.
I appreciate it.
You know, you say we'll give you some tomorrow.
Yeah, no, nice one. Thank you very much for your time, Aaron. I appreciate it.
Hey, you're
right,
welcome.
Man. Take care.
All right, thanks.
So there we have it. If you have romantic notions of Tyson through the 1980s, the notions I had, really, you might well have been shaking your head through that, but it's always interesting to hear someone with a view that goes against the grain. And Aaron definitely does that. It was great to grab him on the Hall of Fame grounds, which I found out, by the way, is not the best place to grab someone, as there are always so many things going on and so many distractions. But I really did appreciate Aaron taking the time out to share his story. Before I leave you guys, we are brought to you by Hanson Lee Resourcing. That's Blaz and the gang, who have been with us for many, many episodes. They've banked more than 150 episodes of Boxing Life Stories. And quite frankly, we wouldn't be going if it wasn't for Blaz and his gang at Hanson Lee Resourcing. They were voted the UK's best specialist insurance sector recruitment firm at the Corporate Excellence Awards. Not only do Hanson Lee find you the best people, but they'll help you retain them. And you can find out more at hansonlee.com. And we'll be back next week.